like to invite Rob Palme to come forward. He has volunteered, and we are very excited about his talk about universalism and the sea.
Today, we are a church which combines two what were two faiths, the Unitarian and the Universalist. My inspiration for this, or impetus, when I joined this church about 5 years ago, I made friends with Bob Eddy, who was our minister emeritus, and we had many conversations, and he filled me in on Unitarianism, and he had cited to quite an extent on his bicycle going across Europe from Transylvania and on. You may remember his talks there. And when he left us to go north, I want to open an email, continue our conversations with him. And at the same time, I was planning a trip up to my family in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And I planned to visit the church there. I found that that was the first Universalist church in this country. I began to realize that a lot of my life had been sort of bumping up against these Universalists, and I just never really knew it. I thought I could start putting that together. Unfortunately, Bob died before we could really get this going, and I had all this stuff I'd looked up. So I put together for a possible newsletter, and now I'm going to bore you with this whole story here now. Where Bob had used his bicycle to traverse the capitals and university towns of Europe, tracing Universalism, I realized that in my pursuit of the sea, I had actually traced quite a bit of the, he was Unitarianism, I was Universalism. My background, I'd joined the Navy, and I'd actually gone past Gloucester many times on picket duty in the North Atlantic. Pretty familiar with that body of water. My wife, late wife, was from a Norwegian fishing family, and I did commercial fishing on their family boats. This one picture was, I do that, it was a day when all the hydraulics failed and we had to manually haul nets. I kind of realized what the old fisherman did. And I did some sailing. That's the biggest one I was on. It was the Artemis that called at Pensacola, and I got on board. I actually shipped as an engineer, not a sailor. But also, my college was Tufts, which was founded by Jose Ballou, who was the nephew of another Jose Ballou. They weren't too original with names in New England, just any old thing, just keep it on. But it was founded and served as the seminary for the Universalist ministry. Harvard College was where they turned out the Unitarians. And some of the conversations I had there, I don't believe any of the divinity students were going to become Universalist ministers. They all went congregational. The Universalism was sort of dying out at that point. When I got there, I had been in a Unitarian church in New York, and so as a Unitarian, I thought I might get accepted. But the Unitarians were a bunch of Boston snobs, Brahmins, they got into all sorts of spacey stuff. Where the Universalists were the sort of practical, the religion for the working people, and. So they put me in my place. Just to kind of set the scene here, I need to go back into a little bit of religious history. You're all familiar with the Reformation, and the Reformation came out with we basically had the Church of Rome remained. The Lutherans pretty much dominated Northern Europe. The Calvinists, Central Europe, the Protestant elements in France, and the Episcopal Church in England. There was a theological split in this, and also it was a great opportunity for people to steal everybody else's stuff. Like King Henry just loved to confiscate the property of the Church of Rome, for instance. And there's always those little undercurrents that in history that they don't really get into. A lot of factions and wars. Calvinists, they tended to pander to an elite group. They were the people that did have money. They had an idea of predestination. They had a God that micromanaged everything. And if you were predestined, you could get away with all sorts of stuff because, you're on the fast track. And other people were pretty much non-persons. And this has been a tendency in society over the years to, you have all these non-people you don't have to worry about. Now, in England, my experiences there, they're very class conscious. When I was there as a naval officer, I was nicely taken care of. When I went as a Yankee tourist, sit in the back of the pub somewhere where you don't get in the way of the darts. The English, your family name, your estate, things like that were what made you important. Coming on the scene in the 1600s, John and Charles Wesley and George Whitefield formed up what was called Methodism, and they began to serve a part of the population that had been pretty much unchurched. These were people, I had this picture from Constable, the bargeman, which was one of my little contacts when I was on my ship going up the Thames River under pilotage and talking with a pilot, and saw these barges there, and there'd be one guy out there on this barge floating around. So shouldn't we render assistance, and he explained to me, these men knew that river. They could go from, it was London to Deptford was the destinations, in two tides, and they had a barge, a pole, and a rope. And the pilot admired their seamanship, and when a pilot admires somebody's seamanship, these guys know something. If you've got a bunch of very intelligent people, but they're not educated, disciplined, and so forth. Churches, generally, one of the functions that we are very concerned with death and the idea of salvation and afterlife is a very good selling point for the church. Kind of like that. And then there are people that maybe don't back their church as much as they should and don't attend as much as they should and may hang out with the wrong people. And therefore, we need something like hell. And hell is a very handy tool to keep people in line. It would fill the pews and make people their contribution. Now, in most of these countries, and I'll be talking about New England, attendance at church was legally mandated. If you missed church, it wasn't the preacher that called, it was the sheriff. And we all wanted to go to heaven. Now, how do we get there? Well, your Christ or God would hold the keys to it, but then we had various types of We could have a very authoritative, ruling God, or we could have a very kindly, friendly God. Now, in Christian heritage, you are told that thy will be done, and you can interpret that either pass the buck to God, it's your will, not mine, or I'm supposed to do thy will. Religion is really handy, just try to use it right. Most of the churches came from a feudal heritage, and their God was a feudal prince or lord who ruled things. Many of us have experienced, and may not, I don't know how many, but that feeling that around here they call it being born again. John Wesley said it was a strange, warm feeling. You get it sometime when there's something a little outside of yourself that gets inside you, and it's a little strange. Churches can interpret that in various ways. But it happens to enough people that you can get a sort of an adherence to a religion when you associate the two. Now, the Universalists started in Wales in around 1756. There was a Methodist minister, John Relly. God went into his Bible, and you go into a Bible, you come up with something, and when you come up the other side, he came out that Christ in his sacrifice on the cross did it for all of mankind, not just for a few. And he went with that, people didn't like that because the power of the church was very much lessened if everybody was already saved. James had to go to London where there were enough people he could form a congregation. And another minister, John Murray, was pretty much sent by the Methodists to straighten out this guy, Relly. And it worked the other way around. Murray got convinced by Relly that what he was saying was right. And he started preaching, and between the two of them, what we now call Universalism was formed up. The adherents to it at the time were called Rallyites. And this was from a Charles Buck, and he was describing it in London, professing to believe in a baptism of the mind, not of the skin, that the principle and only the reason we're put here, God's will, is to help one another to make this a better world for our fellow man. So that was basically the Universalist heresy. John Murray's wife died, and his child, a lot of disease in those days. He was wondering what to do with his life, and so he, like many other fellows like that, he set out for the new world, a new life in the new world. I love the names they gave things. His ship was called the Hand in Hand, and it got lost in a storm off the American coast and ended up on the beach in New Jersey, just outside Barnegat Bay, in a water I knew pretty well, where I went to my prep school. He got into the town called Good Luck, which was 6 miles south of where my prep school was, and it was on Forked River, which we would go to for sailboat races, but that's the only contact I had with that. I didn't nothing religious. In the area in New Jersey, from New York, the Dutch were extremely liberal and tolerant. They were the ones that actually took in and accepted Jews when they were being persecuted throughout Europe. The English took over New York, but the Dutch culture remained there. South of that, we had Swedes, Norwegians, Danes. On down to Philadelphia, we got some oddball people like Quakers and Moravians. The a farmer, and this was the way they did it at the time, he had built a church in case any minister came through, he could preach there. And that's kind of how the churches worked then. And then he got Murray to preach there fairly often. Then Murray rode around the countryside, other churches like that preached. And he worked his way up into New England. And New England was a theocracy. It was very much run by the church. But actually, if we're going to go with the first Universalist sermons in this country were preached in New Jersey, but I'm going to be giving Gloucester the credit. Gloucester was north of Boston. It was a fishing town, working people, pretty much in trade. They were sitting on some of the best fishing grounds, which they really were just starting to exploit. A lot of seafaring people, and at that time, the only true wealth was land, and it was only landowners who had citizenship that could vote. So you could own a nice ship, and you could have a lot of money and stuff like that, but if you were living in rented quarters, you weren't really like a citizen. There was a landowning family there, the Sargents, and they had a lot of friends. Raleigh, back in England, published pamphlets. They were a handy way to make some quick money. Not much, but some. Gloucester being a trading town, ships coming and going, pamphlets small over were very much good reading material. We this will surprise you, we didn't have the internet then. This was the way news got around, by sailors would bring their tales, embellished, of course, and pamphlets, books were very rare. Making a book was a big deal. Had to sew the thing together by hand, and quite a job. Not many people owned books, but the only book around was the Bible. People were very religious, and the only source of information was the Bible for many, many people. Science had really not got a foothold yet. So the Gloucester had a lot of stuff going on, mostly based on the water. Now, fishing, they're starting to fish offshore. They have plenty of fish inshore. Actually, a poor man's meal in Gloucester in those days was a lobster. You just wade on the shore and pick the things up. First time I visited Gloucester, I'd ran a sailboat in Marblehead and sailed up there. You couldn't dock anywhere. These schooners were all either loading ice or unloading fish all over the place. North Atlantic, which I'm familiar with, can be pretty rough, and the best fishing grounds are on the banks off of Newfoundland. I had one patrol up there for a month, and my memory, it actually was pretty good weather for the banks, fog. Thick fog, day in, day out. Couldn't establish our position. Couldn't see the sun or the stars for many days. The Atlantic is kind of a tough thing. A lot of the things that form the population, their attitudes, the zeitgeist of Gloucester. The fishing, many would go out fishing. Some would come back. They were lost. And in a very religious thing with all the forms and funerals and so forth, they were just gone. You never knew what happened to them. Enough of this went on in Gloucester that one of the features there, which kind of got me, their town memorial has plaques which memorialize the men lost at sea. See, 1873, I believe it was. There were, I think it was 173 men that did not come back. So it was, you take life pretty seriously there. The sergeant and his group took in Murray, and they enjoyed his preaching, and he was a fairly important fellow. He sponsored Murray, and then later on, the building of that first Universalist church. He had a daughter, Judith, who was married a merchant who had... He put his money in a privateer and made some money during the Revolution, and then he went back into being a merchant, lost his shirt, headed out for the Virgin Islands to escape the debtors, and he died down there, and then Judith married Murray. She wrote a book, which I have just read. She was very worried about it wasn't ladylike to write books and things like that. They found her papers and republished them. She and Murray, they got along fine. Murray was a very happy-go-lucky sort of fellow. Any money he had, he'd invested badly, and she'd usually save his cookies and was always sponging off her family to keep them afloat. So it's a minister's life, I guess, anything like that. I point out that land was wealth. A town would have one church, and everyone paid taxes to it. They established the not the physical church, but a church group. And Sargent refused to pay taxes to the other church. So the sheriff came and confiscated candlesticks and some spoons. So they had to organize the church. And the whole thing ended up with the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but that's another story. The seafaring people were just another life form. They didn't own property. Who were they? They're sort of non-entities. The captains had social status. Most of them actually owned a house. Well, they owned a house in Marblehead, not Gloucester. Murray was a priest in Gloucester, but he got on his horse and went up down as far as Philadelphia. When the war started in 1775, Concord Bridge and all that stuff, he took a commission as a chaplain in the forces around Boston. The other chaplains discovered his deep heresy. He did not believe in hell, and they demanded he be put out of the army and removed as a chaplain, totally unfit. And they petitioned George Washington, and George took action. He promoted him. Rebellious sort of a guy, wasn't he? He was a sickly fellow. Most of his life, he was, and it was easy to get sick in those days. I mean, the water was foul, and mosquitoes and bugs and everything else. Pretty easy. Boston ministers were very mad at him because, again, he didn't believe in that. And anyone that didn't believe in hell is going to be, well, you know, they're going to act like sailors. What they're going to do? We don't know how low-life sailors are, so they just knew it all worked out. One church in Gloucester wanted him thrown out as a vagrant, and so Sargent gave him a little bit of land, so then he owned land, and he was a citizen then. Winthrop then donated the land on which that first church was built. His daughter, after her first husband died, and Murray was actually sort of boarding at the Sargent house, and so they married, and then about 1779 they formed the Independent Christian Church, which was the Universalist Church. That's what they called it. 1793, after the Revolution, people had a lot of hopes for the Revolution. Actually, women were hoping to get the right to vote or something, or at least Judith wanted the right to go to Harvard, is what she wanted. You had to go to Philadelphia to find a higher education that would take in women. Murray got a church in Boston, which had a congregation of 1,500 people, which was pretty big. So the Universalists were catching on in Boston, and Universalism was catching on in this new country. People liked the idea that you're going to go to heaven. We're not all going to go to hell. Now, of course, I turned the radio on a couple of days ago, and there's a preacher on the radio telling me I'm going to go to hell. But it's a matter of opinion. Never know till you get there. Well, Murray and his wife took a trip. He went, by one source says, to England, the other source says to Philadelphia. Sources, you know. But when he was away, there was a minister who was very popular in New Hampshire called Jose Ballou, and preached a good sermon, so he had Jose take over the church. And when Ballou came back, most of the parishioners were pretty mad at Jose because Jose was a Unitarian and the foundation of the Universalists was Trinitarian. They believed that it was Jesus Christ's sacrifice that got them all into heaven. And you get a sticking point like that, and boy, it's tough. Basically, they did find common ground. The Unitarians were very much based on academic logic, reason, and the Universalists were very much an emotional, things that felt right were right, and it seemed about right that we're all going to go to heaven, and that everybody's going to go to heaven, doesn't matter what church you go to. Now, one misconception I will hit here, the Universalists are not the ones that went into everybody else's religion and sort of encompassed it and studied. That was actually studied by the Unitarians in their transcendental phase. And the, of course, we were trading, particularly out of Boston, worldwide. We had agents in foreign ports, sailors bringing back foreign wives. So there was a big, the seas were a great common. They were sort of politically uncomfortable for the politicians because you couldn't survey it and stake out a square plot of land or anything on the sea. The sea was just open. It flowed. And ports of call were important. And it was easier to get from one port of call to another than it was to get from New York to Philadelphia. And sometimes a year you couldn't get there. The roads were all mud. They didn't have paving or anything. So there was common ground. And so they sort of had a truce. They did not merge. And Jose Ballou is credited with being the organizer, basically, of the Universalist Church. So right now, the present Unitarian Universalist Church in Gloucester is that. Their minister is I think her first name was Ann. His pastor was her last name. Nice lady and a Tufts graduate. The construction of the church was started in 1805, and I know that the country was in a complete financial mess after the Revolution. Everybody was printing their own money, and it wasn't worth a dime. You know, the only real money is what you stole silver from the Spanish or a little piracy would get to put something in your pocket that jingled. So that was the beginning of Universalism. And it's gone through phases. I haven't really looked into all that. And the two Unitarians, Universalists, merged because they had common ground with the civil rights movement. And that got them together. So that was really the connection between Universalism and the sea. If you want to talk about this a little more, I'll be available after I get some coffee after the service thing.